They received the sum of £7.10 and were told, quote, would be glad to see them again when they had another to dispose of.
In 1952, Argentina's beloved Eva Perón dies at age 33, but her journey is far from over.
I'm Jennifer Coffeen.
And I'm Fraser Coffeen.
And this is Creepy History.
Welcome back to Creepy History.
Hello, it's season two, part two.
Season 2.2. Yes, we had a little bit of a break there. Yep. Season 2.1.
That's right.
Was over summer, and now we're back for the fall.
That's right. You have to do Creepy History in the fall.
It's a must.
Yeah.
It's a must. So we took a little bit of a pause, but now we're here.
That's right. It's October. It's Halloween time. We're ready.
Yeah. It's going to be creepy.
I'm trying to strategically choose my stories.
Nice.
For
good.
Halloween.
Yeah. For maximum Halloweening.
Yeah. You know, I wanted something, campfire story. Which
sure.
Possibly mine is tonight. Like sort of, you know, and then, I don't know, ghost.
We have
horror.
A special, we'll have a Halloween episode sure. coming up soon. And I have mine all selected for that Halloween
you
episode.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty excited for it. I have a good idea, but I don't know if it should be my Halloween one.
Okay.
It might just be like a regular one.
We'll have to see.
All right.
Awesome. Hey, before we get into tonight's, I have a little bit of a callback to our last episode, which was a while ago.
Yeah.
So you might need
really
a refresher.
Impressed that you remember our last
Thank
episode.
Thank you. Thank you. But in our last episode, you talked about premature burial.
Correct.
Right? And you talked about some of the different ways that people dealt with premature burial back in the day. You know, yep. smoke enemas, foot torture, safety coffins, things like that.
Yeah.
So
bell on the coffin.
Yep, exactly. So I looked it up in Mary Roach's Stiff,
mm-hmm,
where she
like
also talks about
book.
It. Great book. I did something on that just recently. And found a little section where she talks about it.
Yes.
Can I give you a couple other quick examples
of
how people dealt with this? Okay, so this comes from Mary Roach, and she's quoting from a guy named Jan Bondesen, who wrote a book called Buried Alive. Awesome.
I know, you need to read that book.
Clearly need to read that. Anyway, this is what Mary Roach has to say. She says she's talking about different things about this fear that they had about being buried alive and ways that they were dealing that. So she says, quote, the techniques seem to fall into two categories. Those that purported to rouse the unconscious patient with unspeakable pain and... and those that threw in a measure of humiliation.
Oh, jeez.
The soles of the feet were sliced with razors.
Oh.
Yeah, you mentioned that one. And needles jammed beneath toenails. Ears were assaulted with bugle fanfares and hideous shrieks and excessive noises. One French clergyman recommended thrusting a red-hot poker up what Bondesen genteelly refers to as, quote, the rear passage.
No.
A French physician invented a set of nipple pincers, specifically for the purposes of reanimation. Another invented, this one you mentioned, a bagpipe-like contraption for administering tobacco enemas.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yep. The 17th century anatomist Jacob Winslow entreated his colleagues to pour boiling Spanish wax on patients' foreheads and warm urine into their mouths.
What?
Yep. Two more.
People were getting a little bit too much.
They're getting a little too much. One Swedish tract on the matter suggested that a crawling insect be put into the corpse's ear. And
so it can go in there forever and infect them?
Yep. Well, they're dead, you know. And finally, for simplicity and originality, nothing quite matches the thrusting of a sharp pencil up the cadaver's nose. There you go. So that's how they dealt with
Here's fears. What I want to know. Did it ever actually revive anyone?
Like, she,
did it ever work?
I would have to read over carefully, but I believe she says no.
So this you're just basically doing never awful works. Things.
Yeah.
And people, I wonder, and I hope people are doing like one thing and then being done. I'm really fearful that they're doing like a whole bunch of things.
Well,
and like having a party about it.
You're fearful that they got into this business for ulterior motives.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, for sure. Well, it became like a thing. I mean, because I'm sure it was just to sell.
Yeah.
You're like, well, this and this is the thing and this is the thing, you know, just to like freak people out. Because again, I think it was extraordinarily rare type of thing to happen, but it was the hysteria.
It was the fear.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Absolutely.
All right. Good stuff. Our drink.
Yeah, I'm excited.
All right. So this is, I had to go buy something special for this. It's called Fernet Branca.
I've never heard of this.
Neither had I.
I'm going to smell it.
Yeah, give it a whiff. Okay. All right, what do we think?
Ooh, it smells, oh, geez.
That is your response to 95% of our creepy cocktails.
That's really fair. It smells like almost like whiskey-esque.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that is the central ingredient, the Fernet Branca, is the central ingredient in what we're drinking, a Fernet con Coca, a.k.a. Fernet with Coke.
What does Fernet mean?
Fernet is that drink
that you're holding in your hand. What is it? Like, what kind of liqueur is it?
It's Fernet. It is what it is.
It is what it is?
Yeah, that's what it is. That's like saying, what kind of liquor is gin? Mm, it's Fernet.
That's fair.
So this is Fernet con Coca. It's Fernet and Coke, or you have Fernet and Diet Coke.
Hey, thanks.
No problem. So this is the some would say the unofficial drink of Argentina.
Really?
Yes.
Didn't know that.
So a little quick history for it. It's sometimes called the Fernando or the Fernandito. And in the late 1800s, there was a big population shift from a lot of Italians emigrating to Argentina.
Uh-huh.
And this is an Italian liqueur, but it's very popular in Argentina. And they brought it with them. And it first caught on as like a digestif, you know, after dinner little thing. That's its kind of its original thing. But then, I find this really fascinating, then in the mid-20th century, Coke and Fernet... They got together in Argentina, some marketing bigwigs over there, and they're like, hey, we got a plan. We need to get Coke more popular. Yep. We need to get Fernet more popular. Let's launch the Fernet con Coca, big marketing campaign to be like, this is our drink. And it worked. It totally worked.
People are into it.
People got totally into it.
It also has a really, like, a fancy name.
Yeah, Fernet con Coca.
Yeah, it sounds good.
But it's actually not a fancy drink. It is a very, like, it's like a college town drink there.
Yeah, I was
about
to say, like, what you drink in the club.
Yep, yeah. It's a college drink. It's a club drink. It's thought of as the drink that you have when you're hungover.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, that's the Fernet con Coca. And then, fascinating little end of this, it's now so popular... That's 70, even though it's an Italian liquor,
uh-huh.
75% of the world's consumption of Fernet is in Argentina. And Argentina is the only place in the world outside of Italy who is authorized to make it.
Wow.
So there you go.
Because that's the thing. I mean, I've been to Italy a couple times. I've never seen it.
No, it's moved over there. They don't drink it.
That's funny.
So right. I have no idea what it's going to taste like.
I'm ready.
No clue. Let's give it a shot.
I hope it doesn't taste like Southern Comfort.
It's going to taste like college.
It's almost a little minty.
There is a mintiness. I agree with that. Yeah. It's really weird.
It is kind of weird.
It's a little like...
Yours is probably sweeter. Let me taste yours.
Sure. Give mine a shot. It's not very sweet, though.
Ugh. Yeah. It's bitter.
It's like...
I'm just going to slide that across the room.
It's like toothpaste.
Yeah. It's like toothpaste.
Hmm. Maybe that's why it's a hangover drink, because your mouth needs some cleaning.
Oh, all right.
Oh, this is not a winner.
Good job. Good job. It was a really good one.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's pretty intense.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Faithful listeners, I cannot in good conscience recommend the Fernet con Coca for all of our Argentinian listeners.
And now
I truly apologize.
We're going to have this bottle forever.
I'm going to have to look up other recipes to make with Fernet.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think you're that bitterness. All right.
Oh, boy.
Moving on.
All right. What can you do?
You know, you got to try it.
You try things.
Sorry for anyone who enjoys that in Argentina.
You know, we had Malort back in the day.
I know. We had Malort. We should never talk about what anyone else drinks.
Yeah. Everybody, if you haven't had a Malort shot lately, please help yourself to one.
Okay. You ready? Mine's a little bit long.
I know.
It's really bad.
Yeah.
Don't drink it anymore.
I can do it. All right, I'm ready.
Okay. Ready?
Yeah. I'm ready. I'm prepared. I've had the Fernet con Coca.
Okay.
I couldn't be more ready.
I am going to do... This is one of my top stories. This is one of my, like, reason why I wanted to do this podcast.
Oh, all right.
I'm going to do the story of Birkin Hair.
Oh, I suspected from your teaser that's what it was. How exciting. Birkin Hair, you know, definitely one of, along with Lizzie Borden, he've already done.
Sure.
I think of as one of the quintessential, like, early times that I knew Jen was into creepy stuff.
And I just started, I would just randomly talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Parties and people would just stare at me.
Yeah, I wish I could have kept a counter over the years of how many times you've kind of made a way to finagle them into conversation. A lot.
Aw,
but in a good way. Yeah, yeah. It's not the easiest sometimes, but you do it.
Yeah. So this is a hefty story.
Okay,
so all right. I probably condensed some of it, but it's a good one. This is one of my faves. All right. So we're going to start out by talking a little bit about body snatching. I don't feel like you can even get into the Birkenhair narrative until you talk about body snatching.
Sure, sure.
Also, I did research on Wikipedia and PBS.org and just random stuff that I already knew. Okay.
Your brain.
And my own
my
brain.
Source was me.
a bunch of ghost tours I took in Scotland. Okay. So we're going to start out in the 19th century Scotland. At that time, Edinburgh was a leading place for medical and anatomical research. And in order to study human bodies, this was becoming like, you know, this sort of next step in science, right? And
sure.
So, you know, they were learning a lot more. They were really starting to study it. They were really starting to make progress. But medical students needed human cadavers to cut up, right? So where did they come from?
Yes, this relates to the one that I did about the botched surgery, right? Because
exactly.
they didn't practice much.
Nowadays they actually have like probably quite a lot of computer stuff where you can study and like things like that. But I mean, back then it's like you had to open up the body and learn.
Yeah, and Mary Roach,
they still use cadavers. Now.
Yeah, Mary Roach talks about that a lot, right? A lot of people donate their body to science,
right? But now you can like do it, and they have like a system and everything. But back then, so I found this really interesting. Scottish law at the time said that corpses could be used for medical research, but they can only come from people who died in prison, suicide victims, or orphans.
Oh, yeah.
I know.
Orphans?
It's really bad. So because of religious reasons, you couldn't just randomly donate your body to science like you can now,
sure.
Right?
But an orphan has no soul.
An orphan. No. Oh, it's the worst.
Oh.
Jeez. I didn't think of it that way.
That's what they're saying.
I know.
Oh,
it's even sadder. Okay. So, by the early 1800s, there was actually sort of less bodies. I think most of them were coming out of the prisons. There were less executions, and there were more medical schools. So it was becoming a bigger issue as, you know, they needed more and people were getting executed less.
This is classic economics, supply and demand.
Exactly. It was becoming. Plus, there was poor refrigeration, obviously, at the time. And so it meant that the bodies had to be very fresh or they sort of weren't, you know, of good use to the medical students.
Sure.
Which was even harder to get. So it'd sort of be like you needed to die and then like bring them right over. So basically this meant that there weren't enough donated bodies to go around for the medical students. And so this led to a group called the Resurrection Men. So these are men who dig up fresh graves after a funeral, they steal the body and they sell it to the university to use for medical research. This is also known as body snatching. These people would work in teams. Actually, it wasn't only just men. They would send women in the group to spy on funerals and scout out the graves.
Oh, nice. Okay. Sophisticated operation.
Yeah. They often targeted mass graves for the poor. So I didn't realize this either. People who didn't have family money to bury them or whatever. Like, I guess the state was burying them or something. Or Scotland. The city. They would left uncovered, like the grave was like huge, and then they would leave it completely uncovered until it was completely full of coffins, and then they would like bury it.
Oh, okay.
So that's what they used to do. So, I mean, obviously this is like easy pickings
sure.
for someone who's going to go in and steal a body because they don't have to dig it up. So that was usually the ones that they went after. Also, let's see, did I write in here? Part of why they would go for like the poor people, you know, so a lot of family members were starting to catch on that this was happening and they would start to like stay and like overnight for like two nights or whatever. And like, keep watch because after a couple days, the body wasn't good to them anyway.
Got it.
Or they would, use like, there is this thing called mort safes. I don't know if I'm saying that right. It's like a very weird cage.
Oh yes. I've heard of this, that they would put around the coffin.
I'll put a picture up on our Instagram. It's hilarious. I mean, it's huge. It's like this sort of giant, like cage like thing that just fits exactly over like the grave or the coffin, and then you know you can't really get to it. Authorities and the medical community really turned a blind eye to this. They accepted it as kind of a necessary evil in the name of science. So the thought was sort of like, you know, listen, this isn't the best, but you know, we're making scientific breakthroughs, which could possibly save lives and make things better for people. So like, this is just what
you
got to
do. Yes.
Yeah. But it was kept very quiet from the public, because back then, you know, probably as now, people would just not find it acceptable.
Right.
And, it was, many people in Scotland at that time had a literal belief in the resurrection, which means that they thought that the body would come back to life after death. Like after,
you know,
like Jesus came and things like that. So it was like the idea of desecrating the body for them was like a huge deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And so it would, if people found out, which they did sometimes, it would cause riots, it would cause fighting, like they would go after the people, they would sort of, you know, it was like mob death. It was bad.
Yeah.
So grave robbing could be very lucrative, but it was dangerous. It was very unpredictable. And interestingly, it was this like kind of a slap on the wrist to steal a body. Like they didn't really do much about it. But if you stole jewelry or items off the body, it was considered like, you know, thievery, and then it was a much more punishable crime.
Interesting. Okay.
So the body itself was like, meh,
yeah, yeah.
But like any objects that you stole out of there, because that's like grave robbing, which is different.
Where yeah.
You like go in and like steal the jewelry people put or whatever items they put in there. And that actually was quite, you know, bad.
Sure. That seems bad.
Okay. So that is body snatching. So I'm now introducing our main people. William Burke, who was born in 1792 in Ireland. He had a comfortable upbringing. He got married at 18. He later abandoned his wife and kids. Classy.
Good job.
Moved to Scotland and became a laborer, you know, as you do. There he meets a woman named Heather McDougall. Her nickname was Nellie. And they moved to Edinburgh together in 1827. She became his wife, but nobody says anything. But I'm like, wasn't he still married? I don't think he got divorced.
Probably
I think he
not.
Just, like,
right.
Took off. Yeah. But whatever. Once they get to Edinburgh, they make their lives as living as cobblers. They're hawkers. Which I guess
what is a hawker?
A hawker is, like, somebody who, like, hawks wares.
Okay.
Like, hawks
okay.
stuff, you know. I guess it's, like, kind of, like,
yeah, sure.
selling stuff.
Yeah.
You know, probably junk or stolen items or whatever. They were known for like going to church. Burke often carried around a Bible, so, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's Burke and Nellie. We have William Hare. William Hare's origins are less known. He was also born in Ireland sometime in the early 1800s. We don't really have an exact date. He worked as a laborer, and he was described, as from someone who knew him as, quote, illiterate and uncouth, a lean, quarrelsome, violent, and amoral character with the scars from old wounds about his head and brow.
Oh, jeez. So rough
guy.
He's
like a real fun guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he lodged at a place in Edinburgh called Tanner's Close, and it's the house of a man named Logue and his wife Margaret. When Logue, am I saying that right? I'm probably not saying that right.
I think so.
L-O-G-E.
Yeah, Logue.
Okay, anyway. When he dies in 1826, and William Hare may or may not have married Margaret, but basically they start, you know, became a couple. In 1827, Burke and Nellie move into that area. They meet William Hare and Margaret, and then they eventually move into Tanner's Close, into that lodging house.
Mm-hmm.
And the two couples, you know, like start living together, and they have a reputation for hard drinking and partying, and they're sort of like, you know, I think Burke and Nellie are kind of also helping them run this lodge, and they're all kind of living there. Now it gets real.
All right.
Here we go. So on November 29th, 1827, a lodger who's living in Tanner's Close, named Donald, he dies of dropsy.
Oh, poor dropsy.
House. I know, right?
I feel like we've had somebody die of dropsy in a previous episode.
Well, I looked up dropsy, and because I'm like, what is that exactly, right? And, I mean, basically it's just, like, really severe inflammation and swelling.
Huh.
So,
that's not what I envision. I envision some sort of fainting disease.
Right.
Oh, dropsy. Something
like
that.
No, it's like, they show pictures of it, and it's like, you know, like, when people, like, swell up a lot, or like their, you know, extremities swell up or something, like that's dropsy.
Okay.
You know, But I don't know. I mean, does it kill you? I don't know. Or is it like back then they were just like, oh, it must be the dropsy. Are they like super swollen? I don't know.
Who knows? Exactly, yeah.
What happened, but he died
great,
of something.
It's a great name.
Yeah. So William Hare was extremely mad about this because Donald still owed him 4 pounds for rent.
Sure.
And now he's not going to get his money. So, Burke suggests that they sell the body to the local, anatomy students at the University of Edinburgh. He's like, this is a way you can, you know, make back our money.
Really? The guy owes it to us.
That's right. It's not the worst thing in the world, I guess. Like, at this point, there's a sort of being, you know.
I mean, like, unless you believe in the literal resurrection, and then it doesn't seem that 4 pounds sure. is worth,
yeah, yeah,
somebody's it's worth sold. being a zombie in yeah, the afterlife.
That's fair. So they
you get have to go around the entire afterlife with, like, no head. It's gonna suck.
That's a bummer. So they get a carpenter to provide, like, a cheap coffin for a burial. It was paid for by the local parish. And then, sort of when everyone leaves, they open the coffin, they take out the body, they hide it under the bed, they fill the coffin with bark, and then put it back.
Uh-huh.
Got it. Nobody's going to know. They then take the body to the university, and it was interesting. They're looking for another guy. I don't know if it was like a student or another like doctor or something. And one of the students is like, oh, no, you want Dr. Knox.
That's your guy.
So Dr. Robert Knox isn't he's a doctor. And apparently I don't know, he was the guy to go to if you had dead bodies.
They just knew that he was willing to take him.
I know. It was funny.
I like that you get that reputation.
I know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they receive at the time, they get £7.10, which was, you know, quite a lot of money for them. They kind of split it up, and they are told by the students that they would be glad to see them again when they had another to dispose of, meaning, you know, if you got any more bodies.
Yeah, come on by.
Bye. Thanks for bringing this one.
I'm your guy.
Yeah. So no one really knows exactly how things happened next, like, you know, really, like, what happened. So Burke later makes 2 confessions, but they're different. Like, the chain of events is different, each one. And then Hare makes a statement, like, later after everything happens, and his is different from Burke. So, like, they have, you know, nobody's 100% sure of the timeline.
Okay.
But according to, like, some writers and researchers and stuff, it's thought that in January or February of 1828, so just a few months later, a miller named Joseph was staying at Hare's lodge, and he becomes ill with fever. So Hare becomes very concerned. He doesn't want a sick lodger in his house. It's really bad for business. People won't come, you know, et cetera, et cetera, especially if somebody passes away. And he decides to take action. So they give Joseph whiskey until he's sort of, like, passed out. And then Hare suffocates Joseph while Burke lays across the upper torso to restrict movement.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really interesting. Yeah, you've probably heard
about
this.
With a pillow?
I believe he was actually... So that's something that's disputed as well. Like,
okay.
I think some people are like, it was a pillow. Some people are like, they're using their hands.
Okay, got it.
So Burke's weight is on the victim, and it stifles his movement, so he can't make noise. And it also prevents the chest from expanding, so that it, like, no air can get past, Hare's like super, he's like suffocating him, but then it won't even let
air.
It like suffocates him faster, basically.
Sure.
So in many people's opinions, the method would be practically undetectable until the era of modern forensics. So, like, it was really, really hard to detect. Like, the way that they were doing it made it hard to detect that he had been, like, forcibly suffocated.
Right, yes.
So this method of killing later becomes quite famous after they confess of it, and people, like, hear about how they actually did it, and it's called Burking.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't know if you've ever heard that before.
No.
But, like, the idea of, like having, like, 2 people, like, one person sort of laying on the upper torso to restrict movement, and then with the weight, and then...
Why does this just get saddled on Burke? There are 2 people.
I know, right? Well, you'll find out later.
Oh, okay.
So it's interesting. I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's, like, in the, like, the last, like, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, whatever, there's, like, a famous murder case in Las Vegas where the woman and her, like, lover, they kill her husband in very similar manner. And it's, you know, it's Burking.
That's good. Yeah, that's the official name. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't remember the whole story. But anyway. Okay. So they suffocate Joseph. They take his corpse to Dr. Knox, who now pays them £10.
Oh, it's going up.
Right. So the next victim is a traveling seller of matches and Tinder. Who also falls ill at Hare's lodging house with jaundice. So some of this sounds a little, I mean, they're, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
They're probably trying to make themselves sound better.
He was almost
so
dead.
So once again, they're concerned that the illness might affect the business. And so they do the same thing and, you know, they suffocate him.
They burk him.
After this, they decide to branch out. So now they've just been using lodgers who apparently may or may not have been ill, whatever. Now they actually, for the first time, go out to find somebody.
All right.
So Abigail Simpson is like sort of an older woman who lives in a nearby village. She visits the city, like, you know, on occasion to sell salt to make some extra money. So on February 8, 1828, she was invited into the Harris house to like have a drink and chat, and they give her a ton of alcohol.
No, it's not going well for her.
Super drunk, yeah, exactly.
No, Abigail, no.
I know. They take her salt bag, and they murder her in the same way that they've done everybody else, and then they place her body in a tea chest and they sell it to Dr. Knox, and they receive £10. When Burke is confessing, he states and quoted, Dr. Knox approved of it being so fresh, but he did not ask any questions. So again, we'll talk about this later. You know, was it suspicious?
Well, yeah.
Dr. Knox, did he not care? Did this happen all the time? Did he feel like, you know, or did he just think that they were like, you know, catching these bodies like before they went into the ground? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But he wasn't obviously like really looking into it. So later that year, February or March, another old woman is invited to the house by Margaret Hare. So this is important because now, the women are involved as well. She gives her enough whiskey to fall asleep. And then Hare returns that afternoon. And he covers the woman's mouth and nose with a mattress cover and then leaves her there and comes back at night. And she's like dead.
It's a riff on burking. It's not exactly burking.
And it's interesting too, because like this time, like they kind of did it themselves.
Yeah.
So, and then, so they, you know, they take it into Knox, they get paid another £10. Burke meets two women in early April, Mary Patterson and Janet Brown. He buys the two women alcohol, invites them back to his house for breakfast, to the lodge. The three, are just sitting around drinking and chatting. Mary Patterson falls asleep at the table, and then Burke and Janet continue talking, but then Nellie shows up and she's like super angry and she accuses them of having an affair.
Oh.
And then a fight breaks out and apparently Burke threw a glass and cuts Nellie in the eye. Janet is like, I'm out.
Well, as, yes, wisely.
So she leaves her friend and she just like goes. Nellie leaves to go get Hare and Margaret, and they come back, lock their wives out of the room, and then murder Mary Patterson in her sleep. Now, this is really interesting because, you know, like, Janet was a witness. Like, she knew that they went to the house, and then when she left, you know, whatever. So they're getting a little bit
more risk. Yeah.
Yeah. The men take the body to Knox again in a tea chest. Nellie keeps Mary Patterson's skirt and petticoats. and the body is still warm when they deliver it.
Sure.
Because, I mean, they just, like, kill her and then just take her
right
there.
Just take her right there, yeah.
Ferguson, one of Dr. Knox's assistants, he recognizes the body.
Oh.
And they sort of ask where they got it.
Yeah.
And Berg explains that the girl had drunk herself to death, and then they purchased it from, like, an old woman. So Dr. Knox is like, whatever. He's super excited. And apparently, this is just like an added thing. He stores it in whiskey for 3 months before he dissects it.
What?
I don't know what was going on with that.
To
preserve it?
I guess.
I mean, alcohol, it would, like, formaldehyde is
sure,
like alcohol.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know. Yikes.
That's weird.
Gross.
Did the whiskey afterwards taste like Fernet con coca?
Oh, gross. They probably all drank it.
Probably.
Oh, that's really bad. That's awful.
Sorry, just threw that out there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so then Janet Brown later comes searching for her friend, for Mary, and she's told that she left with, like, some guy. She's like, she left, went to Glasgow, she's gone.
We don't know what happened to her, it could be anything.
Yeah. Okay, so Mrs. Haldane, who is described as a stout old woman, she lodges at Hare's at the... I forgot the name of it. What was it called? Oh, well. At the lodge.
The lodge.
And she becomes drunk. She falls asleep in the stable, and she's smothered.
Burked. Drunk. Burked, sleep.
Thrown
burked.
In the tea chest. Down to Dr. Knox. Several months later, her daughter comes and lodges at the house, and she and Burke drink heavily together, and he kills her without Hare's assistance, puts her in the tea chest, over to Knox.
Ah, solo Burking.
Yeah. The next murder occurs in May 1828, so, I mean, they're just doing a lot, right? They started in November. Another woman comes in as a lodger, she gets intoxicated. This is very much a pattern. Burke smothers her. And again, Hare is not in the house. Let's see. There came the murder of Effie, who was a cinder gatherer.
So I think
she gathered things out of the garbage.
Okay.
So like cinder was like garbage.
Okay. All right.
I think that's right.
Sure.
Like a rubbish bin type thing.
Sounds good.
She had, known him. She sold him scraps of leather for his business. And, you know, again, he lures her in, you know, et cetera. You know the drill.
They're getting burked. They're getting burked all over the place. Yeah.
So this goes on and on and on. And so, one of the more notable ones is Burke and Hare. They murder two lodgers in June, which was an old woman and a boy, her grandson. And at this one, Burke later says in his confession that it disturbed him the most. And he was haunted by the boy and all that. And then they put him in the tea chest. And the bodies, the tea chest is too small to put both the bodies in there. So they put him in a herring barrel. Yeah. And I think at this point, they've really, really crossed some sort of very serious threshold.
Yeah, it's getting rough themselves. Here. Right.
So they're getting quite sloppy and reckless at this point. Like, they're just doing it constantly. They're not really paying attention to who's watching them and, that kind of stuff. On June 24th of that year, Burke and Nellie depart. They go on a trip to visit Nellie's father. And when they come back, Burke notices that Hare is wearing new fancy clothes and he has extra money. And so he's like, what's going on? And Hare's like, nothing. And, then he finds out that, Hare had sold a woman's body, for £8. And then they start to argue and they get physical, which I mean, Burke's been doing it with that Hare not there. I don't know. Maybe he's telling him about it. So at this point, Burke and Nellie move out. And they go and live with their cousin in another lodging house, nearby.
They're breaking up the team.
Yeah, but it doesn't last that long. So by October, Hare and Burke they end up killing a washerwoman who comes to the property to do laundry. It's literally anybody who walks in there.
You just show up and you're not coming back. Ugh.
Then they go after one of Nellie's relatives, Anne Dougal, was visiting, and they kill her. I mean,
This is like the second act of Sweeney Todd when they're just killing everybody, putting them into pies.
It's like, does Nellie not care? Is no one off limits?
Yeah.
So interesting, at this point, Margaret Hare suggests that they kill Nellie.
Oh, jeez.
Because they could not trust her as she was a Scotch woman.
Okay. Awesome.
And they're all Irish, but of course they are refused.
How do you come back from that conversation?
I know, right?
Okay, we won't. Never mind.
I was just joking.
It's okay. We won't kill her. You're cool, Nellie. You're cool.
Yeah, she's just in the room while they're talking.
Hey!
I think also they were drunk all the time.
Well, sure, yeah.
All the time. Like, Burke actually, I don't know if I wrote it in here, but he actually talks about how at this period he cannot sleep without being extremely drunk. And he'll wake up in the middle of the night, from nightmares and stuff, and he'll just, gulp down. He leaves whiskey by the bed, and he just, gulps down half the bottle till it, knocks him out again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's in an awful, dark, evil place.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the difference between people who are, sociopaths, who just do not have feelings, versus people who are still doing evil things, but feel it.
Yeah, yeah.
And which is somehow even worse.
Yeah, sure.
Like, how do you function when you know you're doing something?
No, he's not
really
functioning
evil.
Very well.
No,
right?
He's really, so they're just absolutely falling apart. The next victim, and this is important. So it's a familiar person, a known person in Edinburgh. His name is James Wilson. He's an 18-year-old man. He has, like, a limp. He has some disabilities. He's kind of mentally disabled, and he's kind of locally known as Daft Jamie.
No.
I know, right? Okay. So they lure him in.
Oh, jeez.
I know. And then they murder him. Now, here's the thing. So they try to get him drunk, but Jamie doesn't really like whiskey. He doesn't really, you know, he doesn't like the taste. He prefers snuff.
Okay, sure.
He's also, so he doesn't really, he's not really that drunk when they take him back. And he's also quite strong.
I was going to say, he's 18.
Yeah, he's 18. He's probably strong. He's probably like, the man, you know, labor, yeah. Whatever. So he fights back, and but he eventually is overpowered, and you know they kill him like they did everybody else. They steal all his stuff. Apparently, Bert kept the snuff box, and Hare kept the snuff spoon.
Uh-huh.
They take his body to Dr. Knox the next day, and many of the students recognized him.
Oh, right. I forgot, of course. Yeah, because he's, like, well-known around town.
Yeah.
It seems like a bad
idea. I think at this point, they started to, like, talk, and I think it upset some people. Like, I think it was, like, super clear. Like, people had, like, seen him the day before, and now he's turned up dead by these men who keep bringing the bodies. Like, people were getting it, and they knew something, like, bad happened, and they were not happy about it. Dr. Knox really denies it. So some rumors start circulating, and Knox ends up dissecting Jamie's body very quickly, and so he basically couldn't be identified.
Okay.
So, again, he knew, you know what I mean? Like, there, anyway.
Yeah.
He knew what was going on.
Of course.
The final victim is killed on Halloween, October 31st, 1828.
Ooh.
Margaret Dockery? Yeah, we'll say whatever.
Dockerty.
Yeah, Dockerty. There you go. She is a middle-aged Irish woman. Burke lures her into his cousin's lodging house.
Okay.
Cousin's like, yeah, thanks a lot. By claiming that his mother was also a Dockerty from the same part of Ireland.
The Dockerty's coming together.
Terrible.
Yeah.
They start drinking.
Yeah.
He leaves her hanging out with Nellie. He goes to get more whiskey, but he actually goes and gets hair. So there are a couple other lodgers who are staying at his cousin's house, Anne and James Gray. And they basically pay them to go stay at Hare's lodging house for the night to get rid of them. Which, again, this is just a terrible plan. They've seen you.
Yeah, yeah.
They've seen this woman.
Yeah.
They drink all night, and then Margaret's there. She's drinking, too. And about 9 o'clock, the Grays return to collect a couple things. And they see Burke and Hare and the wives, like, all drunk, singing and dancing with this, you know, this older woman. They basically murder her. They put her body in a pile of straw at the end of the bed. The next day, this couple, the Grays, return, and Anne is very suspicious.
Well, yeah, like, as you would be.
I'm sure it doesn't look good in there. Burke won't let her, like, go, like, approach the bed where she left some of her stuff.
No.
They're not allowed to be alone in the house, you know, that kind of stuff. So finally, I think at some point they're left alone and they search the straw and they find this, you know, woman's body.
Yep.
And it has like blood on her face and stuff like that. So they go straight to the police. Like they leave. And then on the way they run into Nellie who tries to bribe them. And they're like, nope. So they finally, somebody reports to the police. Burke and Hare immediately remove the body. They take it straight down to Dr. Knox. The police search. They find Dockerty's bloodstained clothing under the bed. Everybody's giving different stories. They get taken in for questioning. And then eventually the police, after the question, they go into Dr. Knox's dissecting rooms and they find the body.
Okay.
And James Gray identifies her as the woman he had seen with Burke and Hare. And that's it. Like,
yep.
The jig is up. Hare and his wife and everybody else is, you know, they're all arrested. Everybody denies everything. In total, 16 people were murdered by Burke and Hare.
That's way more than I thought. I thought it was like 4 or something.
Burke later, this is what I said earlier. He later stated that he and Hare were generally in a state of intoxication when the murders were carried out. He could not sleep at night without a bottle of whiskey by his bedside and a 2-penny candle to burn all night beside him. When he awoke, he would take a drink from the bottle, sometimes half a bottle, and that would make him sleep. He also took opium to ease his conscience.
Oh, man.
Like, opium
is a mess.
Not going to help
you. Right, right, right.
All right. So the trial and the aftermath. So it's a huge trial,
obviously. Yeah, big sensational thing,
right? Yeah, it's all over the newspaper. Everybody's talking about it. Burke and Hare immediately blame each other for the murders. They're both charged with murder along with both their wives. Dr. Knox claims he thought Burke and Hare had watched a poor lodging house and purchased the bodies before anyone could claim them for burial. So yeah, he's like, I just figured they were staking out a place, which, I mean, that's fair. But I don't know.
Yeah.
So they don't really have enough evidence to kind of convict them for all these murders, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the bodies are gone. People, there's just not a lot of witnesses. You know, it's kind of tough.
Yeah.
So they sort of do like kind of this newer thing at the time, which is basically to like offer full immunity to one person to testify against the other person. Okay. So they offer it to Hare. They offer him full immunity if he confesses and testifies against Burke and his wife.
That seems like he's totally going to do
that. Hare's like, thumbs up.
Yeah, he seems here for it. He seems primed to do that.
Yeah, so he makes a full confession, and that's how, again, this is how we have so much knowledge and, like, so much information. And then Burke and Nellie are put on trial for murder. I think once they were arrested, they started really yapping, like, talking. So, long story, the trial was, like, you know, you can kind of look it up if you want to know more about the trial. But Burke is convicted. He's sentenced to death. Nellie is found not guilty.
Oh, all right.
Nellie, interestingly, so she is released from prison where she was during the trial. And she is essentially chased out of the city by a mob.
Wow.
Like, she's chased somewhere. The police kind of have to rescue her. I think they let her stay somewhere, like, overnight. And then when they release her, like, she's just, like, getting chased again. And, like, they just kind of run her out of town. Like, it's,
as you do, you know.
I mean, you get what you get.
Yeah.
Burke is hanged on the morning of January 28th, 1829. So, I mean, fast, right? In front of a crowd, possibly as large as 25,000.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know if there's, a square in Edinburgh where they would hang people, and it kind of, like, slopes downward. Uh-huh. So there's, like, a plaque. I probably took you to
I remember seeing it,
and then there's, like, you know, and I think they would burn witches there as well. And then, but it makes it very easy for a large crowd to see because it, like, slopes upward if you're, like, in the crowd, which is messed up, but that's what was happening.
Yeah, it's like he's on a hill. Yeah,
it was, like, on a hill in the city. On February 1st, his corpse is publicly dissected by a Professor Monroe in the anatomy theater in the university.
Wow.
Police have to be called during this time because of all the students demanding access. And there's, like, a limited number of tickets.
You got to see Burke get dissected.
Right? So a little riot ensues. The only way they can calm it down is... when they sort of, you know, promise the crowd that everyone will be allowed to pass through the theater in batches of 50 after the dissection. So everybody can go through and take a look. The procedure lasts 2 hours. At one point, Monroe dips his quill pen into Burke's blood and writes, on what he wrote it on, I do not know. But he writes, and I quote, "This is written with the blood of William Burke, who was hanged at Edinburgh. This blood was taken from his head."
That is messed up. What a messed up thing to do.
So messed up.
Where is that document? Why have we not seen that in some museum somewhere?
I need to find out what he wrote it on. It doesn't
say. And where that thing is.
I know.
Oh, man. That's fascinating. I want to see that.
So Burke's skeleton was given to the Anatomical Museum of the Edinburgh Medical School. Where it's still there.
Okay.
His death mask and a book said to be bound with his tanned skin.
Ooh.
That means what they skinned off his dead body and made a book out of, can be seen at the Surgeons Hall Museum. Hare was released on February 5th of that year. He was also chased out of the city.
Good. Well done, people of Edinburgh.
It was a similar thing where, like, they sort of chased him, and then the police kind of helped it. And then basically the police kind of take him to the English border, the Scottish-English border, and, like, dump him out, and they're like, good luck.
Yeah.
Like, don't come back. Dr. Knox refused to make any public statements about his involvement with Burke and Hare. It was very much thought in Edinburgh that he was, you know, a part of these events. He knew what was going on.
Yeah.
He was, like, they had caricatures of him in cartoons, and he was made fun of all the time. In the papers, and in February that year, a crowd gathered outside of his house and burned an effigy of him. So Edinburgh folks were not...
No, they were not into this.
...having it.
Yeah.
They're like, get out, get out.
I appreciate it. They're just like, done with you.
Your face.
All of you.
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah. So he eventually leaves. He resigns his position, and he was sort of excluded from university life by his peers. I think he kind of got, like, a lesser job somewhere small and, like, lived out the rest of his days. Because nobody wanted to be around him.
Nobody wanted, because he's a jerk face and nobody wants to deal with him.
It wasn't a good choice. So, interestingly, one last little tidbit about body snatching.
Oh, nice, good.
This, all of this that happened, so this was like the late 1820s, you know, in Edinburgh. So in 1832, they passed the Anatomy Act, which made body snatching a criminal offense.
Oh.
So it was sort of directly, you know, from this, I think it just pushed people too far.
Yeah.
Interestingly, body snatching still kept going. Even in, like, in 1875, the bodies of typhoid-affected students at a Canadian convent school were stolen before their relatives could arrive to claim them.
Wow. Okay.
So, like, it just kind of still happened. So as late as 2006, four men were charged with body stealing. They had been selling body parts they attained without consent from corpses in morgues and funeral homes in New York City. The body parts were sold for transplant and medical study.
Wow.
I think I saw an American Greed about that, if that's the right story. Interesting. Where, like, they were actually using them for, like, to transplant into living people, which is so bad.
That's crazy.
Anyway, that is the story of Broken Hair.
That is awesome. Oh, thank you.
Yep.
I knew pieces of it, but not the whole thing.
It's good stuff.
Thank you. I'd like to cheers at the end of things, but A, I don't know who in your story to give a cheers to, and B, I'm not drinking another sip of that for now.
No, let's just let it go, because now it's going to taste like a dead body, right?
Like a whiskey fermented,
body like fermented that lady whiskey. Whose body was left in the whiskey for 3 months. That's what it tastes
that's
like.
That's what it's going to be like, with a dash of the herrings that the other body was left in for months.
Oh,
yeah. Delicious.
We were not very nice to that drink.
No, thanks. Nice job. Thank you for that. I see you have switched to water.
Water with a tiny bit of lemon.
Just a dash of lemon. That's a much better drink. I have a little bit of a headache, and I wonder if it's from the Fernet. I didn't drink remotely my entire drink.
Yeah, you said, like, a couple sips. Don't drink anymore.
No, I'm not going to.
Yeah.
We just have to stop talking
about this drink. Maybe it's the ghost of Broken Hair.
Possibly. Getting into my brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're thinking about body snatchers, you know, but in the last episode I talked about Sir Astley Cooper, the British surgeon whose son was the idiot who did the, or his nephew rather, was the idiot who did the messed up surgery. Astley Cooper was kind of a Knox-esque figure, though I don't think people were being murdered, but he was, like, known as, like, the guy that you brought the dead bodies, the illegally obtained dead bodies to. So there's a little controversy surrounding him. He was the guy.
Yeah.
But people also say that that's what made him such a good, ultimately such a good surgeon, is that he got all of these bodies illegally.
And was able to
like, practice on them, and that's why he was skilled.
Yeah, it was a messed up system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very complicated. All right, on we go. So my story is inspired by something you talked about a couple episodes ago, when you talked about the Argentinian woman who died twice.
Yes.
Yes. And we talked briefly in that one about Eva Perón being buried.
Buried at the same cemetery.
At the same cemetery. And so that kind of prompted me to think about a story I'd heard once before, and that is the tale of Eva Perón's body.
Ooh.
Do you know anything about this?
I really don't. I know she's buried at that cemetery, and that's about it.
Well, there's way more to it. I'm excited. Okay, so real quick crash course on the life of Eva Perón, for those of you who have not seen Evita lately.
Never seen Evita.
Oh, Evita's a good show.
I know. I don't know why I missed it.
Totally a good show.
Yeah.
You know, it's Andrew Lloyd Webber. He's good.
Yeah.
What can you do? It's not about cats. It's not about trains. It's a good show.
It's not about roller skating.
That's the train one.
Oh,
yeah.
I haven't seen that one either.
Oh, that show's great. Starlight Express, classic. Such a good show. Ugh, I could go on about Starlight Express for days, but I won't. So anyway, Eva Perón, crash course in her life. So she was born in poverty in a rural village in Argentina in 1919, maybe? It's a little bit unclear exactly when she was born. But her father left the family when he was one, or when she was one, not when he was one, obviously, when Eva was one. And it's very sad. He left because they were like not his real family. He had like an actual real legal family, and he like was like, I've just been hanging out with you guys for a little while. Peace out. I'm going back to them.
He's like, well, I best get back.
Yeah.
He must have been there for a while. Obviously. At least a couple of years.
Yeah. But then it just goes back. I think he was maybe going back and forth, and then yeah, he just is like, I'm done cutting you off.
What a piece of garbage.
Yeah, he's trash. So you know, so she's single mother, which obviously doesn't.
Yeah.
It's very difficult in poverty. Not easy. Great. Right. Not good. So at the age of 15, Ava runs off to Buenos Aires to become a star. She wants to become a movie star. And she does. She becomes very, very popular.
Isn't it funny when it works out? Like, yeah. How many 15-year-old, you know, poor girls run away and then...
Yeah,
know, like,
yeah. She did.
Horrible. And then you know, it's like, I made it.
I know. She does quite well for herself. And again, to be clear, the bulk of our story is later, so this is the very condensed version of her life. In 1944, at the age of 24, we're just going to go with assuming she was born in 1919, though again, it's a little unclear. At the age of 24, she met Juan Perón, a rising politician. She was performing at some sort of political benefit rally thing, and they met, you know, struck up a romance between the 24-year-old Ava and the 48-year-old Juan.
Jeez.
Yep. 1 year later, 1945, they get married. Year after that, 1946, Juan Perón becomes the president of Argentina.
Yep.
And both Juan and Ava are extraordinarily popular. They're seen as, you know, the politicians for the people, right? They represent the people, the working class of Argentina. And Ava, in particular, really embodies this, largely because of her background, right? She came from them. She's one of the people.
She's a working woman. She was an actor. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and she's really seen is this. She begins to take on these almost like saint-like qualities. Some people refer to him as like Santa Evita. And she gains this like real, like, you know, very big like cult in a positive way around her. They, of course, obviously have enemies. You know, the Perones are more sort of progressive and, you know, socialist a little bit more. Their enemies are the more conservative, you know, parts of the government. In 1952, Ava is named the, quote, spiritual leader of the nation by Juan Perón. That's her official title. Spiritual leader of the nation.
Wow.
Bold, eh?
That's a very bold title.
It's a big title.
A lot to live up to.
Yep.
It's weird that your husband gave it to you.
It's intense.
Yep.
By that time, she's already very sick with cervical cancer, though she doesn't,
she's so young.
Tell anybody. She keeps it very quiet. You know, continues to make public appearances despite
being ill.
Did they
know it was, like, cervical cancer? Back then, I feel like.
I think so. Yeah, I think that they did. Yeah. On July 26, 1952, at age 33, she dies of...
Sorry, how old?
33.
Okay. Oh, gosh, that's really young.
Dies of cervical cancer. So, very unfortunate. Her funeral is very, very famous, very well known. The estimate is that 3 million people, 3 million people attend her funeral. At one point, they have to move her body, like as part of the funeral procession, and there's such a surge of people trying to get closer to the body. It's like, you know, it's like those terrible things from like the Who concert in the 70s, stuff like that. There's such a like surge of people that 2,000 people are injured and 8 people are killed.
Oh my gosh.
So it's just,
also,
you know,
if you're in a crowd of 3 million people, what do you think you're going to see? Do you think you're going to get to that body?
Yeah, you're not.
You think
it's not
you're
going to
get up front and see something?
Yep.
Like, who? Yeah. I don't know. It's nuts to me. I guess the ones, like, surrounding it maybe, but, like, wow.
Yeah. So that just goes to show the level of, like, fame for her. So this is where our story begins.
All right.
Okay? So, she's dead.
Yep.
And she, at this point, is embalmed. Mm-hmm. It is assumed that this is Juan's decision, not hers, because she never, nobody has any record of her ever indicating that she wants to be embalmed. So okay. Juan had her embalmed. And he makes plans for an absolutely massive monument to honor her.
Yep.
The plan is that it will be this huge thing right there in the middle of Buenos Aires, larger than the Statue of Liberty.
Wow.
And it will be, you know, this monument to her, and her body will be buried in the base of this giant monument.
It is quite large.
Yeah, very large. Work does indeed begin on this. He drafts plans. They start to work. Okay. Now, of course, that's ultimately where her body's going to be. This is going to take a little while, sure. Right? They're not going to make that, you know, over the weekend. it's going to be a bit. So her body is stored in one of the in this union office of a workers' union that she was affiliated with, and her body is stored in that office for 2 years. While they work on this thing.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, you guys.
Can we put her body
in? Do you know that you remember you need a desk?
Yeah. What we've got.
This is going to be your desk.
Is the body.
Slip this coffin.
Yeah, it'll be fine.
Right up here.
But don't worry. It contains the spiritual leader of the nation.
That's right.
So it's fine. So as they're working on this, things go a little bit south. Because in 1955, Juan Perón is ousted in a military coup.
Mm-hmm.
And he is forced to flee for his life and escape Argentina just, you know, to get out of there sure. alive and not be assassinated. He succeeds. He does get out.
And this is 4 years after her death?
3 years after. 1955. Death. Okay. He does manage to get out, but, you know, it's dicey. He's not able to take her body with him, obviously.
Yeah.
So Eva's body is left there. Juan is accused of treason, and the new regime that comes in his place, they work to really, they really sort of ban Peronism, which is the name of what's come up, you know, okay. surrounding them. They try to remove all aspects of Peronism. They forbid any songs about the two of them. Mm-hmm. They forbid pictures. They forbid writing. They really try to silence any discussion of them. In particular, again, of Eva herself, because sure.
She was such a figure.
Glamorous, yeah. known figure. So they shut that down. And that's in 1955. Juan has left. Peronism is shut down. And at that point, Eva's body, the whereabouts, become unknown.
Wow, no.
Until 1971.
Whoa!
There is a 16-year period in there where...
I didn't know any of this.
Her body is missing. There's graffiti that goes up around Buenos Aires at the time saying, where is the body of Eva Perón?
Wow.
It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
She's gone. And again, you know, she is this, like, you know, this, like... major figure. She's this like saint to them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would be like if like Princess Diana's body was just like gone.
Right.
You know?
And I think it's the idea too, where you have that, you know, for some people's belief system, like the fact that it's not have giving a proper resting
yes.
place or a proper
yes.
burial place is just really upsetting.
Yes.
You know?
Right. Yes.
It's very sacrilegious.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very religious nation, you
yeah.
know? And so, yeah, this is a thing, you know?
Yeah, it's a huge dishonor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. At some point, or in 1971, it is discovered that she has been buried in a crypt in mm-hmm. Milan, Italy.
Whoa.
Under a false name, Maria Maggi.
Why?
There is a crypt in Italy named for Maria Maggi.
So nobody can visit
and
or
that's
can't
Eva
be
Perón.
Like a place of...
Well, ultimately, it's kind of pieced together what happened. So here's, you know, it's not perfect. The process of how she got to that crypt is a little bit unclear, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of things that people know. During this 16-year period, again, she started in that office,
mm-hmm.
but she was moved all over the place. She was stored in the back of a van parked on the street mm-hmm. for a long time.
Were the people moving her like...
It's unclear.
Okay.
It's unclear. She was stored behind a movie screen in Buenos Aires for a period of time.
Hmm.
In the city's waterworks building.
Oh.
In the military offices.
Well, that's not good. All kinds so I of wonder things. If they're just trying to move her around so that no one
yes,
can find her.
I think
her.
So. Just move
if
her.
Obviously, I was thinking, I was like, it's either one of two things, right? It's either like people trying to protect the body. So they, yes. so the military people don't, so the new regime doesn't get her body. So like we have to hide the body so they can't get the
no,
body.
No, the military regime is the one who's
they
kind
took
of
it.
Doing
okay.
it. Yes.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. So like, yeah. but they're obviously like, you wonder why they just didn't straight up like destroy it unless they felt like they couldn't
yeah.
or didn't want, you know what I mean?
Hard
like
to know.
Maybe use
right.
it for their favor later or something.
Possibly.
But like, we're, I mean, it, you know, it's not easy to just have a body.
Well, that's why they're moving it to all these right. weird places. So somehow or other, again, the details here are sketchy, but somehow or other in 1957, the Vatican is able to step in and help the situation. And the Vatican helps sneak her out of the country. And it's the Vatican who buries her in Milan
wow.
under this name.
Why? You wonder why are they getting involved? I mean,
because of these, because of these
yeah.
figures, you know, because of this, these like saint aspect,
yeah,
you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
To be clear, she's not a saint,
right?
But like, you know,
yeah.
but she's, you know, she was, you know, the spiritual leader of the nation, you know? So yeah, somehow or other the Vatican sneaks her out and buries her there. But, again, it's not until, and that's in 1957. So she's buried there for about 14 years
yeah.
before, anyone identifies that Maria Maggi is Eva Perón
mm-hmm.
and before Juan knows. So in 1971, Juan finds out.
He's still alive?
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
Still, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
He's still alive. He's living in Madrid.
Okay.
1971. He is, yeah, he's alive. He's living in Madrid. He's remarried to
mm-hmm.
a woman named Isabel. And he finds this out. So he has her exhumed.
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, this is indeed Eva's body. He makes the decision, you know, maybe I find this a curious decision, your mileage may vary, but he decides to keep Eva's body in the house.
Oh, jeez.
They place it in their dining room on a little platform next to the table, in a little corpse, you know,
what?
In a little coffin on a little platform next to the table, by the dining table.
Oh,
that's Eva.
God.
She's dead. There's her corpse.
Like, obviously they could at that time in Madrid, but, like, are you... You're not allowed to do that, I don't think, anymore.
I don't know. I don't know. We're in a whole
Jeez.
Weird world of people who have been, you know, ousted from their military positions.
Sure.
He's,
all right.
He's doing
Poor
his thing.
Isabel's like, are we doing
That's
this?
What I think of her. I think
like,
of her as
come
well.
On.
Come on, man.
Like, do I have...
Anyway.
Is this really what my dining room's going to look like?
Apparently, yeah. So, in... So that's in 71 that he gets that corpse, Eva's corpse, and it's now in his dining room. 1973, 2 years later, there is a shift in the government in Argentina, and Perón is able to make his return.
Oh, wow.
The,
okay.
the people who had overthrown him fall out of power, and he returns to Argentina, and, amazingly, he becomes the president again.
I'm serious?
Yeah, 1973. President.
I'm ashamed that
president
I didn't know
once again. I know,
yeah.
kind of fascinating, eh? And continuing his fine tradition from before, he names Isabel, his new wife, the vice president. So the Perones are back.
They're back.
But it's now Juan and Isabel instead of Juan and Eva. Not as,
yeah,
you know,
poor Isabel. That's got to be rough.
I know. Not as popular, you know,
sure.
but, you know, still popular. For reasons I'm not 100% clear on, he leaves Eva's corpse in Spain. He still has the home in Madrid,
okay.
and he leaves her at that home in Madrid. I'm not sure if he's, like, nervous about bringing her back or what the deal is, but he does not bring her body back to... back.
Also, the logistics of moving a body, you know,
yeah.
from one country to another is not easy. So I can see being like, I'm going to go back,
yeah.
I'll deal with this
We'll
later.
Deal with this at some point. So she's left there. So there's this group, again... Remember, like I said before, graffiti around
yeah.
the streets of Buenos Aires, where is the body of Eva Perón? It's now known. We know where it is.
Yeah.
But it's not in Argentina.
Right.
And there
they
are people
back.
In Argentina who are displeased about this.
Sure.
So even though it's Juan who's doing it, there's, you know, she's more popular than him,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's this group called the Montoneros who are, you know, very angry and demand that the body of Eva be returned to her home country. So they steal the corpse of a prominent general that they had assassinated, a guy named Pedro Eugenio Aramburu. Pedro Eugenio Aramburu. They have, he was a big general
uh-huh.
who was part of the coup in 1955 that ousted the Perones, and he was part of the group that was that like removed her sure. corpse. So they had him, they assassinated him, then they stole his corpse, and then they said, then they tried to leverage the possession of his corpse to demand that Ava be returned. You know, we've got this general, you will give you his body back as long as Ava's returned here to,
I mean,
to our land.
It's a good trade.
Yeah. While they're working on this in 1974, sadly, Juan Perón dies.
Yeah. He's probably pretty old at this point.
He's pretty old at this point. Yeah, he dies. Isabel is the vice president, so Isabel becomes becomes the president.
Hmm.
And one of the first things she does is she brings Ava back.
Aww.
She brings Ava back, and her plan is, because she wants her back kind of right away, she wants to display the two of them together as part of Juan's... you know, mm-hmm. funeral, right? She wants she wants the two of them, Juan and Ava, to be brought together. As a little weird, bizarre thing, so with that, the Montaneros, they still were in that kind of, like, trying to leverage this body thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But now Ava's body has been returned, so they got what they wanted.
They just, like, but throw. They
still, yeah, they dump the body of Pedro Eugenio Aramburu just in the street. Because they're like, well, we don't need this anymore. So they just, like, leave it in the middle of the street and, like, drive away.
Chuck it out the window. Yeah. And, like, see you later.
Yeah. That was the really only funny. Use of it. Yeah, very strange. So she brings him back in order to display. But this is not as easy as you might think. She... Hold on a minute here. Let me check my get my note here. So the body... Again, it was embalmed, but... You know, preparing it to be displayed is quite difficult because it is not in the best shape. Here's a quote from a gentleman.
Oh, that is not.
I know. And this sort of, again, tells us, you know, we don't have clarity about what happened to her body over those years. You know, it's not totally clear. There's just bits and pieces. But here's some stuff we do know about what happened to her body. This is a quote from Carlos Spadone, who's a friend of Juan's, who was there with Juan when the body was returned to him in 1971.
Okay.
And he says, quote, "There was a large dent in the nose, and there were blows to the face and chest and marks on the back. There had also been a serious blow to one knee, but I don't think that she had been strung up or whipped, as some people say. I don't believe that."
Whoa. So they, like, probably did awful things to the body.
There is thoughts that, yeah, the body had been, you know, sort of assaulted in some
way.
Yeah,
sure.
So it needs, so in order, again,
which again, it's weird to me that they... just didn't straight up destroy it.
It's all weird.
You know,
it's all
like weird. Why? I wonder what their rationale was for keeping it, unless they thought maybe they could leverage it.
Yeah, possibly.
Which, yeah, that makes sense.
So, you know, Isabel's plan again is to display this body, but it's not in great shape. We can't mm-hmm. show that, right? So she hires a guy, this guy named Domingo Telechia, to restore the body. He is unsure if he's going to do it or not. He's afraid for his life, right? There's
That's
a lot of
fair.
Political turmoil.
I know. Who wants to be the one to mess that up?
Yeah. Well, to either mess it up or to be the one who restores her, and then there's another military coup, and the enemies come in, and now they come after you. You know, it's bad. But he does. He receives threats for that. He does successfully restore her body. I should have said before. Also, one of the other things. Here's what that guy, Telechia, he reports in his process of restoring her body. He says that she has part of a finger missing. Mm. Says that it shows evidence that she was roughly transported, and that for a long period of time, the coffin was left standing vertically. So, you know, that would mess up her, like, knees and legs and stuff like
that,
right?
Yeah, Juan's dining room.
No, it was horizontal in the dining room.
I thought he was put it up against the wall.
No, on a little platform, a little table.
Got you.
That's
better.
Yes. He reports that there were some sort of compressions to her face, that her foot was disfigured, and that this was all consistent with her being forced into a smaller coffin. So they think that she was perhaps moved in, shoved, like, stuffed into a small, too small coffin. But he does successfully restore her, and they do this. They show the bodies of Juan and Ava. It's not many people go. It's not as big as it was before. It's not the like madcap, you know, millions of people. But it's it's a big thing. And ultimately, then her body is buried, as you said, in their family tomb in La Recoleta in Buenos Aires. This very famous.
Cemetery
there. In order to ensure that nothing like this happens again, Isabel has built this very big, elaborate, safety mechanism for her. So here's her tomb. There is a marble floor, and then there is a trap door, and then there's a level below the marble floor, and in that level below, there's two coffins, both of which are fake. Then that level has a trap door, and underneath that is another level, and that's where Ava is.
Wow.
So she is very, very protected. Juan, not so lucky. Juan's just there.
He just put him right next to it.
He's just buried there. And in 1987, his tomb was disturbed, and his hands were sewn off. So the body of Juan Perón has no hands. His hands are gone. Yeah, that's rough.
Why didn't I just put him all the way down with Ava?
Don't know.
It's not, like, not room down there.
Don't know. Ultimately, so again, that's kind of what we know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of obviously there's a lot of just speculation and unknown and like what exactly is the deal. There's also a lot of misinformation out there. And a lot of the misinformation comes from a book that came out in 1995 called Santa Evita by the author Thomas Eloy Martinez. And it's a work of historical fiction, but, you know, because it's historical fiction, right, it ties into, what was real, and there is some confusion that stems from that. He talks in there, he creates this whole thing where there's, like, wax doubles of Ava.
Mm-hmm.
He has some aspects of, like, necrophilia in his book.
Yeah.
There's no evidence that either of those things happened, but if you read about what happened to her body, a lot of times those things are reported as being what happened, stemming from this book.
Right.
This is not super relevant, but I really like this quote from the New York Times in their review of Santa Evita. It's good stuff. They say, New York Times says, quote, "It's a pity the novel isn't better." Although Mr. Martinez's narrative is enlivened by some magical and highly perverse set pieces, though it possesses moments that genuinely illuminate the bizarre intersection of history, gossip, and legend, the novel as a whole feels leaden and earthbound. In the end, it gives the reader neither a visceral sense of Evita's life nor an understanding of the powerful hold she has exerted on her country's imagination.
Brutal.
I know, rough. Sorry for that, Thomas. But that is the end of the line for her. Again, it's a weird story because there's a lot of unknowns, a lot of holes, a lot of questions. And, clearly we're long past the point where we're ever going to get any definitive answers for any of those things.
Sure.
But that's the saga of her body and what happened to her after she died.
Nice.
Yeah.
Suitably creepy for Halloween.
Thank you.
For
good.
October season.
There you go. All right.
All right. Good stuff.
We'll do a water toast to the Perones.
Yay.
That was a very sad little clink.
I know. There you go.
Yeah, a little better. Awesome.
All right. Thank you guys. And we'll be back next week.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. We'll be, we had a big break there, but we will be back to weekly every single Thursday from now until the end of the year.
Yay.
So stick with us and we'll see you next Thursday.
Bye.
Bye. Hi, this is Fraser with information on next week's Creepy Cocktail. Next week, we'll be having a tequila sunrise. So you need 1.5 ounces tequila, 3/4 cups freshly squeezed orange juice, 3/4 ounce grenadine, and then an orange slice and cherry to garnish. In a glass with ice, add the tequila and the orange juice, and then pour the grenadine in over a spoon, add the garnish, and you've got your tequila sunrise. We'll be having that next week. Hope you can join us. In the meantime, be sure to follow us on Twitter @CreepyHist and Instagram @CreepyHistPod. See you then.